So, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alexander Nehamas. I'm a class of 67. And I'm here with my very old friend, Tom LeCoeur, also a class of 67, to discuss some ideas about friendship. We very much hope that we won't be talking all the time. The very first moment you feel like having that you have a question or having something to contribute, please do, because it won't be like first we talk and then there are questions. We hope we'll have a more lively and interactive discussion. So before we go any further, Thomas LeCoeur, 67.
Right. We're going to talk about friendship because, for one, all of you guys know about it, and two, Alexander turns out to be an expert on the subject. This book came out last year. There's some critical acclaim. And we did a little gig at a bookstore talking about friendship. So in a way, we wanted to do a reprise of that in very short form. But really, we did want to have your view. I mean, that's what this is about. So we wanted your views on the subject. So I should just say that Alexander is one of the few people in the class that I've actually kept up with more or less.
Four or five times a week.
For 50 years. So this strange time lapse that many of us feel, you're like a Disney movie where the flowers open and isn't the case with him. So we roomed together in grad school. We did theater together here. We met when I directed him as Perry White in Joel Schultz's St. Louis Hegelians. And we became close friends, and then he was going to go off and become a rich ship owner.
He destroyed my life.
This is actually true. And he had no firm plans for how to become a rich ship owner. other than his mother wanted him to marry Christine Onassis because her French was perfect. That's what she said. But he didn't marry Christina Nassau. He had no plans for becoming a rich ship owner. He had no other plans. And so I accosted him in the library in May of our senior year and said, I need a roommate in at Princeton. And he hadn't applied to Princeton. or anywhere else. And
It was a low period.
It really was true. He had no plans. No plan B from a rich ship owner. And so he wanted to be a philosopher, but the philosophy was full. So we got him to apply in classics, and he didn't drive. So I drove him to Princeton to be interviewed in classics. And he thought, what have you taken a couple of classics courses here? That basically wasn't your thing. But being a good gymnasium boy, you could decline and conjugate anything. And they didn't ask him anything serious about classics. They just asked him for some verbs and nouns, and he did fine. And so we got into full classics at Princeton, and I got a roommate.
And when they say friends don't exploit one another.
Right, this is what you'll hear. He'll talk about use friendship, which is an instrumental version of friendship. And this is a combination of instrumental use friendship and real friendship. And you'll learn, we'll talk about real friendship. Anyway, so we can be friends then, and we more or less kept up, and we've had it. Three times a week. We talk all the time for 50 years. So it's a rare gift in life to see someone go through all sorts of things in one's life and read each other's weddings and whatever. So we've kept up. So in some sense, this friendship, this talk grows out of a lifelong friendship. It's really one of the only lifelong friendships, continuous lifelong friendships.
Well, we actually taught a seminar together on friendship 10 years ago or more. And I think that's what, in a way, got me started in this book. So it's been, in a very serious sense, a joint project. But we should start talking.
Okay, so I thought, I have a few questions I thought I'd pose to Alexander.
Closer to the mic.
A few questions to pose to Alexander. And we really do encourage you to interrupt and have your views on the subject. And then we'll be completely open. So the first question I was going to ask him, sort of what's interesting about friendship? That is to say, why would a philosopher spend the better part of 10 years writing a book on a subject that seems in some sense at once both self-evident and the other deeply mysterious?
Well, the easy answer is publish or perish, right? I mean,
not by this time. He was the fanciest someone, Professor Princeton, yeah. But that's, anyway, good. That's false.
No, what got me interested was something actually very, very sort of marginal. I was writing a book about beauty and aesthetics, and it occurred to me that it's impossible to love somebody that you don't find attractive, right? If you love somebody, you find them attractive. It's impossible to love somebody and say, what an ugly, horrible person. No, you can't do that. Of course, what each one of us finds beautiful and attractive is different. That's why we constantly say, what does she see in him? What does he see in her? And all that sort of thing. So it occurred to me that was very interesting. And then I realized that with friends, there's something very similar happening. It's not that we find all our friends beautiful, but their looks, whatever they are, become relatively unimportant. And that was driven home to me when I first started teaching at Pittsburgh. There was a colleague there who had polio as a child, and he was completely deformed. I mean, he was hunchback, and his stomach was out here. And the first time I met him, I could not pass his body. I literally couldn't understand where his stomach was and where his shoulders were. Mm-hmm. And we started talking, and we became friends, and one night we were talking, and all of a sudden, as he made some really interesting point, I saw he has those beautiful blue eyes. And then all of a sudden, he was just another person. Not only that, he was also, it turns out, had a whole bunch of affairs on the side, had an illegitimate child. he was a very charming man, and his looks became relatively secondary. And that, I found that very interesting, very sad. I don't particularly have an answer for it. But that was one of the reasons that I got interested. And then it occurred to me that in philosophy, we've been thinking about friendship in one way or another since Aristotle, Plato too, but Aristotle famously devoted 2 of the 10 books of his major work on ethics to philia, which we have generally taken to be friendship. I don't think it is, but nevertheless. But we have followed Aristotle ever since then. And one of the crucial things in Aristotle's view, and in most philosophers' view, is that only good, virtuous people can be friends. And that seemed to me totally absurd. And it's not nothing absurd. It seemed to me that the philosophers who wrote about friendship, Aristotle, Cicero, St. Elred, Aquinas, Francis Bacon, they all had exactly the same view. Even Francis Bacon, the most sort of complicated and accomplished courtier of the world, who changed patrons whenever he changed his view of friendship every time he changed patrons to make it fit, said only the virtuous have real friendship. And that seemed to me totally absurd. It seems to me that most of us are not really virtuous. I mean, we're not evil, but we're not virtuous. Aristotle said only the virtuous, there are very few virtues, so true friendship, he said, is very rare. And you say, who are the virtuous for Aristotle? And the closer he gets is to say Pericles and those around him. Well, that's a very high standard, it seems, and not about to even come close to. So I started thinking about sort of honor among thieves and all that. And then Thelma and Louise came to mind. I don't know if you've seen this film. It's an amazingly wonderful film, actually, and the script for it, which got the Oscar, is terrific. And it's about those two women who have a dead-end life. They go out for a weekend. One of them is almost raped by someone. The other woman shoots him. They go off to... They decide to leave and go to Mexico. In the process, they steal, they rob, they blow up a tanker, they shut a policeman in his trunk, in the car trunk, when he's trying to arrest them. And by the end, they're trapped on the ridge of the Magic Mountain of the Grand Canyon. And they look at one another, and they just drive off. And the last scene of the film is their car in the middle of the opening of the Grand Canyon, and B.B. King is singing, "Don't Look Down Now." But they are extremely admirable through their friendship. In other words, it's not just that friends can do bad things. Of course, everybody knows that. It's that people can become good friends because of bad things they do. And that people can become admirable in a way because these two women become sort of, they become able to run their own lives rather than be pushed around by those two idiotic men that they've been involved with. So that there is something about friendship that doesn't fit with traditional moral, or if you have moralistic views. And yeah, please.
I'm speaking as a neuroscientist, but not claiming this is yet established by neuroscience. It is useful to distinguish human group social behavior from interpersonal human social behavior. Mm-hmm. And you are looking at friendship in one realm and seeing that it doesn't fit the other.
How so? Why doesn't it fit?
And which is the other? Honor among thieves is honor in individual social relations.
That's all I'm talking about.
The idea that some kind of human ideal is required for friendship is talking more about group social
behavior. No, not really. Not really. Aristotle and everybody after him has been talking literally about one-to-one relationships.
The label he used, virtue, is to earn respect by the group. So it comes from group social behavior.
Well, you're raising a really complicated
Could
issue.
I just say, there's a whole chapter on Aristotle. It was the most boring chapter in the but I invite you to have this discussion. I sort of checked out on the two sessions of our seminar in which they did Aristotle, because you had to know Greek, and they were shooting these things, the philology back and forth. But so maybe can we bracket Aristotle? Would you mind? I mean, the technical question of what virtue is.
Yes, please. Let's. Yeah. But I'm very, very glad to talk about it afterwards. But now I have to remember where I was. That's what happens at your 50th anniversary.
We talk about dogs, I think.
No.
You're falling into the grand.
B.B. King.
B.B. King was earlier. No, Honor Among Thieves. So I ended up believing that bad people can be very good friends. And that suggested to me that we have two very different kinds of values by which we live our lives. One group, which is what contemporary thought and most modern thought since about the 16th century has focused its attention on, and those are moral and political values. Values that depend on our similarities with one another, either similarities that already exist or similarities that we hope we can create. And these values encourage or require, actually, a behavior that's impartial. We have to treat everybody the same way, both in politics and in morality, because after all, we are all human beings or rational agents or whatever it is. And what you need is deep down inside the same thing that I need. So there are those values that depend, as I said, on similarity and that make certain similarities good things. But we have completely overlooked another whole family of values, which I like to call, non-moral values, or ethical values, if you want, that have to do much more with our differences from one another. Because we actually value people who do things their own way, people who have their own character, who are distinct individuals. And the issue for me is how to put those two together. How to have a relationship that involves and embodies justice and the reasonable treatment of other people on the one hand, and how at the same time we can strive to accomplish something that is a personal achievement rather than a universal one. Philosophy in particular today has completely overlooked these values. And I think it's time to bring them back. Part of what this book tries to do is to say, look, values like beauty, like friendship, like elegance, if you want, like wit, those are virtues and they're values that are not being discussed because we think that they're too superficial to this, to that, or the other. But I say it's time to do it. And friendship is a particularly good test case because friendship is essentially not impartial. If I'm thinking in terms of morality, I would want to treat ideally everyone in the world the same way. But I'm not going to treat them the same way I treat my friends. Friendship is essentially partial, and if you want to say prejudiced. So I'll commit more of myself to Tom than I will commit myself to somebody with whom I have not a very close relationship, and much more than to someone with whom I have no relationship whatsoever. Whereas in morality, no matter whether I know or don't know anyone, I still need to give them the same things. Yes, please.
I was just wondering, as you're talking and thinking about the ethics of care that Carol Gilligan wrote about,
sure.
And
of Nell Mullings, and I was just wondering, I haven't read your book, so I'm just wondering, is that something that you associate this with?
I actually discuss Carrie Gilligan's stuff. She's also a Swarthmorean, right?
Right.
As a matter of fact. I'm not, and she has changed her mind since the first and very famous book. I think it's not quite as gendered now, the way she looks at things. But one thing that I actually believe here is that although there are profound differences in the behavior of women as friends and the behavior of men as friends, I'm dealing with the issue on a rather more abstract basis, where I'm thinking of friendship as simply a kind of love. And that kind, the kind of love that friendship is, I believe, the same across genders, even though the behavior of the genders is, of the different genders, is very different.
Can I interrupt you? The gender part, because, so one of the things I was going to ask Alexander about was what distinguishes friendship from this wide variety of instrumental relationships and casual relationships in which we all have. I mean, there's all the friends on Facebook, and there's, he has a thing about his friend, the barber, who he goes to all the time, but has a very particular relationship with. So I want to talk a little about what the context of what how friendship is different from all of this.
Right.
And I just want to suggest that one of the things that you brought up and which speaks to the gender issue is when we talk to Thelma Ruiz, he starts telling you the story. And so he says, what is it friends about them? Well, they shot a guy together, and they stuffed him in the trunk, and they got with their husbands. And you've got this whole sort of story. So in that some sense, gendered friendships are gendered in some sense because women have different stories with each other.
Every woman shoots somebody.
Everyone talks about gendering and friendship, but what struck me is that if you think about, I mean, I would propose to you, what think about friendship versus of a serious sort versus all these casual relationships, is more and more stories of and then and then and then, and those can be gendered as our lives are gendered. I mean,
the way to describe a friendship is always, it's never by describing the person, saying, oh, you know, Tom, he's very intelligent and he's sensitive and has, you know, educated and he plays the cello. That's, however, those are each aspects of him that I like. I don't like them just because of those things. And the really serious question for me that I won't get into now is what is it to love somebody, as we say, for themselves, rather than for their money? To say I love you for your money is to say I don't love you. Right? To say I love you because you're intelligent suggests something, but in fact it doesn't explain anything, because the fact that I think Tom is intelligent doesn't mean that if I were to meet somebody more intelligent than him, unlikely is it. That would be, that I would immediately,
not this group,
that I would, so to speak, trade up. You don't do that with your friends, and that's very important. So here is how I distinguish a friendship on the one hand from what I will call an impersonal or an instrumental relationship. So I got this barber in Princeton, right? I went to him because I had tried others and I thought this barber was very good. And I kept going. So at that point, if you ask me, why do you go to
his
Thomas?
His name is also Tom.
Thomas, without an H. So if you ask me at that point, why do you go to this guy? I'd say, yeah, he cuts my hair well. But as I kept going, I started learning more things about him and getting to know him better. And after a while, I started talking about our lives and our families and things like that. And at that point, if you said, why do you go to him? I could no longer say, because it cuts my hair well. It was much more than that. And what's the more is something that I couldn't express. And what showed them another reason that I knew that it was like that is because Tom and my wife at some point tried to get me to change barbers. Because my wife was having her hair cut in New York, so it's fancy barber, I mean hairdresser, whatever. And they thought that this guy would do a much better job on my hair, which I admitted, I think he probably might have. But I wouldn't give up this particular relationship because it was the relationship that I valued, not just what I would get out of the relationship. And that's the real difference. A purely instrumental relationship is, for example, something that you have with a waiter at a restaurant. You know what you want in advance. I want to be served at a time, good food, and politely. Yeah.
So why didn't you go get a decent haircut and take this guy out for dinner?
No, it's a very good question. Because we are not that close. And what I want to suggest is that friendship ranges from the, you know, Montaigne and La Boétie, all the way down to the partial friendship that you have with people. But when you don't have even a partial friendship, then what happens is, as I said, you know what you want, somebody can give it to you. If somebody can do it better, immediately you go to them, right? I mean, if I find a better restaurant, a better waiter, or a better barber, if I'm not, I don't think about it. Whereas when we deal with our friends, no such feature is determinant. On the other hand, of course, we also exploit our friends, even our best friends. Whenever Tom comes to Princeton to visit, he fixes something in my house, and he gets a few ties. we use one another. It's not that we don't, but there is this other element, and that element is what I think we usually try to say. It's the self. I like you as a person, not this part of you or that part of it, all of it.
Well, there's a line he uses from Montaigne, where they ask Montaigne at the end why he's buddies with his best friend, La Boétie, and that's a great essay on friendship, which is the central essay in Montaigne's essay. So Montaigne was really centrally interested in friendship, and Alexander discusses that in the middle of his book, so it's crucial. And the question is, why are you friends with this guy? And the answer is, because he is he and I am I.
He said, if you ask me why I love him, I would say that this cannot be expressed. That's in the first edition of Montaigne's essays. In the third edition of the essays, it says, if you ask me why I loved him, I would have to say this cannot be expressed, except by saying, because it was he, because it was I. Which is a really moving non-definition.
And if you then unpack that, which is why I got into this narrative story, if you then unpacked it and say, what does that mean because I am I and he is he, you'd get just an endless set of stories.
Right.
So why am I friends with Alexander? Any of you speak with each other, we could be here for weeks. And it's sort of, and there's another line that is kind of nice where he said, it's not what you do with your friends that matters, it's what you do with your friends.
Is less important that
you do it with your friends. You know, you build up this set of narratives, and the difference. The reason you don't ask your barber out to dinner is because you didn't go to Swarthmore together, and you didn't fix. You know, I mean, we go through this gazillion stories that all of us have about our friends.
So, can I? Oh, yeah, please.
So, thinking of the line from Aristotle, Cicero, and Montaigne to film it and wait. This thought just came into my head. But aren't Thelma and Louise like really defining a new kind of virtue that's from a female perspective?
I was going to ask you about gender and friendship.
Killing a rapist is a virtuous thing to do, even though it could subject you to legal penalties.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
I would say virtue here is not really the relevant feature. It's admiration. They become admirable. Not virtuous. I mean, they shoot people for no, you know, I mean, you know, the guy was no longer trying to rape the Gina Davis character. They had turned around. He said something. He swore at them. And Susan Sarandon character, because she had been raped earlier in her life, turns around and shoots him. It's more or less a gratuitous killing that would have gotten them in jail. And then when they blow up this oil tanker, the guy was making dirty gestures at them as they were driving, but still, it's one thing for the guy to say, blah, 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 and for you to just blow up this huge tanker into a fireball. That's an excessive reaction. But if you don't mind, Tom has talked about stories, and I believe, in a way, that our friends are, so to speak, inexhaustible. That we always find more things and more things. When we stop finding more things, we stop the friendship. When you realize that there's nothing else to get out of a relationship, or that the relationship offers you nothing, you don't have to stop seeing the people, but the relationship loses its kind of vitality that it had. So here's a story I will tell you about a friend from the book. So let me try to explain this by means of a story. Several years ago, a very good friend, I'll call him Tom because that's his name, was visiting me at home in Princeton. On a cold, wet, gray November morning, as I was getting ready to drive my 10-year-old son to school, Tom decided to come along. And since we're in a hurry and he wasn't going to get out of the car, He threw a raincoat over his pajamas and jumped in. And the raincoat also because my son said, you know, too embarrassing, don't do that. Of course, he was 10. So, traffic in the schoolyard because of the rain, and it was even worse than usual, and we're part of a long, slow queue of cars waiting their turn. When we finally came to the front, as I got out of the car to speed things up for those waiting behind me, I saw that one of my tires was flat. As I stood by the car, cold, wet, and horrified, because I had no idea how to change it, under the eyes of the many annoyed parents in their cars behind us, Tom, in dark blue pajamas, a gray raincoat, and bare feet, leaped out of the car and took over. Changing the tire turned out to be a complicated affair, and every few minutes he had to stop working and move out of the way so that a few of the cars could come by. A crowd gathered. The children mostly stared, fascinated. Actually, my son told me that everybody thought I had the coolest friends. Some adults offered to help, though there was nothing they could do. Others just watched or made various jokes. One, a colleague of mine at the university, told me how lovely she thought Tom's outfit was. Of all that, Tom remained completely oblivious. He fixed the tire, drove me to a garage, discussed the situation with a mechanic, still in pajamas, raincoat, and bare feet, and returned home ready to do some work while I collapsed in a useless heap. So if, as I say, if you were ever to ask me why this fellow is my friend, that story would be certainly one of the things I would tell you. Yeah. And I would try other stories as well. And I would still not be able to explain it. So why not? Why can't we explain it? My guess, and it's just a guess, I don't have proofs or anything like that, is the following. That when you have a friend, or in general, anybody that you love, because friendship is one species of love, and we should think of all those things together, you don't just, so to speak, love them for what you already know about them. The love that you have for a person includes what one could describe as a hope, or sometimes a certainty, or a guess, if you wanted to be pseudoscientific, and say hypothesis, that you haven't learned everything there is to learn about this person, and that the other things that are coming as your relationship goes on are also going to be good and are going to make your life in some way better. Now, that doesn't always work, of course. Like very often it doesn't work at all. But that, in other words, friendship and love in general include, crucially, a commitment to the future. But we don't know this future because, in contrast to the instrumental relationships, where I know already what I want and I can tell whether I got it or not, when I become friends with someone, or when I fall in love with somebody, I actually want to change. I want the things that I want to learn, to value, to appreciate, to do, to know new things because of that relationship, which I wouldn't have done otherwise. And of course, I want to influence the person, I want to be influenced by them, and so both of us change in a relationship like that. So there's no way to predict what will happen. So of course I can't tell you why I love him. Because part of the reason why you love anybody is this dark future, which how can you tell about something that you don't know? And I think that unknown part is basically what we call the self. When we say, I love you for yourself. It's, I love you no matter what, in other words, is going to come out of you. In fact, it doesn't always work like that. But that's a commitment we make.
So I'm just going to put three questions on the floor for you guys to discuss. We can open everything up to this end of my, I have three more questions. One speaks to what's asked about the gendering of friendship, whether friendship is gendered and what your view of this was. Another thing is one that Montaigne talks about, where he thinks that basically, this man, he's told we can't be friends with women because of sex, that sex and friendship are incompatible.
He does say if there were a woman who was good enough, then if you married that woman, from a male point of view, that'd be the best. But of course, unfortunately, yeah.
And obviously, the gendering in Aristotle is clear. You know, the ancients, because only men were could be equal to men, so that in the old days, there's no question. But today, that's no longer the case, and so the issue of gendered friendship might be something that would be interesting to talk about, and the sense of friendship is there in the literature. And the last thing I wanted to think about people talking in the context of our being here is friendship and time. In other words, is it, you know, it's one thing to keep up a youthful friendship, but Alexander and I basically see each other all the time, and there's some of the people I've seen over the years, but many of us have seen each other for the first time in 40 or 50 years. And so some people already talked to you, feel some version of the past there that's going to remake a friendship or feel like friendship. But I'm interested in what people think about this idea of friendship after 50, after a lapse of a half a century, which is really a remarkable period of time. So that's all I have to say, right? Officially.
To pick up on a kind of theme that you just articulated, which was implicitly a kind of surprise and inexhaustibility of the connection. So let me ask you this. Suppose you are dear friends. Could he cease to be a dear friend?
What's the question?
What could you?
You were talking about an inexhaustibility of friendship, that occasionally somebody can change a tire. Occasionally somebody has a skill or...
But he can change a tire only as he can change it. Because many people can change a tire, and I love them. Yeah.
I don't know what that is. Only he can change a tire. But there is an inexhaustibility implicit in the kind of a delight in seeing a new thing about somebody.
Right.
And my question then is, if you have, at point A, a sense of inexhaustibility, of surprise, of delight, can a person cease to be a friend?
Sure.
And what does it take to cease to be a friend? Because that will
further
give us a sense
our
of what you can't time. Articulate.
Ending friendship is a really interesting question that we never got very far within our seminar.
But I don't think I can actually answer the part of the question that's really a question of psychologists rather than for a philosopher who doesn't deal in facts, What do they matter?
We never expected facts from.
But I think what happens at the end of a friendship is either you find out something that you think is horrible about the other person that you haven't seen before, in which case you can either say, he changed, he isn't the person I started liking, or you can say, I was deceived all this time. He really wasn't somebody I wanted to be friends with, but he hid it, so to speak. But more often than that, it is either distance that does it, or a sense that there is not very much new there, that you feel that, you know, you've exhausted the enthusiasm that this inexhaustibility can generate. A friend of mine that moves over to marriage, but I think, again, there are very deep similarities, was thinking of getting a divorce, and we're talking, and he said, I feel as if my life will be the same from now on until I die. And it's that which, to me, signifies the death of a relationship. Now, it doesn't mean that because you stop being friends with somebody, you give them up completely or whatever, you still have a kind of almost an obligation to the relationship, you know. So, you know, you still can deal with that person in a different way than you deal with just somebody whom you don't care about or never cared about at all. But having cared for someone a lot makes a difference to how you deal with them now. You see what I mean?
Or you become somebody else yourself.
Yeah.
That
so
always
the combination
happens.
Of
absolutely.
Distance and change.
That's right. It can change. It can be either point of view. Yeah. You change, and all of a sudden you find out that you've gone in a very different direction from where you were. That's a change that, of course, again, you can't predict at all. So you don't know what you will become as a result of falling in love or starting a friendship. You just don't know. And that lack of knowledge is both, I think, an exhilarating feeling, but at the same time, it brings out it's very dangerous. Because one can, you know, there are at least two ways in which it can be dangerous. One is what Proust describes at the end of Swan's Way, where Swan, this character who has been in love with this woman for many, many years, horribly jealous, he marries her, and one day he says, you know, to think that I have spent the best years of my life to have cried and done and this for a woman who wasn't even my type. Jean, in fact, she's even more petty. That's one way.
Yeah.
Another way, which I think is worse, is when you develop a relationship with somebody and without realizing it, you get perverted and degraded but your standards change at the same time. And so you're happy to live in a way that you would have considered absolutely abominable before you entered that relationship. So then you have been harmed, and you don't even know that you have been harmed.
I think there's a version thing of breaking up. It's basically when a past doesn't sustain a future anymore, when the past becomes a burden rather than more possibilities. I'm thinking, Ruth might have used on this, the breakup of these friendship amongst the romantics, where they had all these very tight, intimate relationships, and then it became more and more burdensome in some sense, however tight.
Coleridge and
Coleridge. Yeah, Coleridge, but you know, they dropped the Quincy. You know, people, they had these guys that had really intense relationships that ended at big time. And so, I don't think I've ever really lost a serious friend, but there's a way that sometimes you feel that a past just won't sustain the kind of more discovery. And so, at some point, you reach the state, the past won't. But I find in close friends, the past does sustain, to me, an engaging future. You know, so that is the fact that we've had these adventures together, that I think there might be more of them. And even if you sometimes, is irritating, doesn't answer the phone for weeks. Yes, you. He doesn't use his cell phone, for example, so it's very hard to reach him. Like, you know, from California, it's hard to get up early enough to get him before he goes. So that is irritating. On the other hand, you sort of forgive him.
Thank you very much.
Where's that pointer?
I don't have anything to say about the romantics, but
you don't?
It seems to be a big difference between breakups or their equivalent in friendship. Where, I mean, I have memories of particular friends with moments such as you described. And what seems to me, at least just speaking for myself, a much more pervasive drift away, that is just a loss, not a moment of conscious disillusionment or conflict at all. But, and you know, your particular friendship has obviously been aided by what I would call institutional structure. I mean, you're both academics at distinguished places where you were likely at one point or another to give a talk at the other place, et cetera. So, I mean, there's a whole set of institutional expectations which enable it, which is not to say that your effort didn't go into it. I don't have an answer or even a question exactly as just thinking about, I mean, I'm very conscious of how many close friends over my adult life or even my childhood life I've just lost, if I were not simply to blame myself for this in a kind of immediately personal way, I would say it has to do with changing personal and professional and physical shifts away. But there are people who are capable of overcoming that drift, and you know I would love to know the gift of it. But it seems to me a very, very strong counterweight to the kind of long-term, I mean, you said, you know, this is among the only, I mean, I don't have anyone, I don't think, that I can think of.
You don't
I have that 50-year, long period of sustained connection.
I have friends from before grade school.
John,
let's see someone else.
You can use the microphone.
We have the mic right here. Roles within a relationship.
Sorry?
Could you talk about roles within a friendship? The two members of a friend pair are not identical people. They are usually complementary in some interesting ways. My son says that preteen boys tend to run in packs of four. There's always a leader, a sidekick, a criminal, and an idiot.
I think many films would verify that.
Yeah. They all have their roles to play, and in a way this carries their story forward and sets them up for further adventures. And I won't ask you to describe a four-way relationship like that, but the idea of a role to play within the friendship is an interesting idea.
That is very interesting. I haven't thought about that very much, but I can certainly say that Tom's role in my life includes his practical aspects. I mean, he really does help. He really does fix the cupboards. You know, it's really, really important. And I have another, I mean, you know, I can't tell you everything. I can't tell you everything I advise him, you know, because some things are too personal. But, I am a source of advice about certain relationships and certain things. I am a source of advice about clothes. You should see the jacket he's going to wear tomorrow. things like that. But I think you're right in a way that many friendships are sort of structured in terms of roles. But very often, those friendships where roles are crucial are often the leader and the follower, right? Mm-hmm. Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin, especially in mystery novels, right? Where every detective has a sergeant or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that these people become friends, and with serialized novels, I mean, series of novels like that, it is like discovering friendships on our own part toward them, right? I mean, if I see Archie Goodwin again in the 17th book and he says, I never gulp orange juice, I only sip it, that's something that I recognize that he said before, right? So I recognize him as someone I have had a past and a history with.
So the other two, Holmes is the leader, Watson is the sidekick, Moriarty is the criminal, and Lestrade is the idiot.
The idiot, right. No, yeah, since Moriarty is a constant thing, there are four, but in most others, there are three. The criminal changes every time. In other words, it'd be boring.
Johnny,
yeah, I wanted to ask about the, if you have generalizations about the circumstances in which friendships are more likely to develop. I know from my own life, I lived somewhere in the Northeast till I was 30, and my friends were either people I went to school with, or people I went to camp with, or people I lived in groups with, or people I was politically active with, especially the last two. Then I moved out to Seattle, and they're really, eventually I did develop some friends, but those circumstances I listed, and for other people it might be a different list, weren't happening anymore. So I wonder, but really it's a question, can you generalize about the circumstance in which it's more likely or less likely?
To some extent, but I think you also have to take another factor into account, and that's age.
Yeah.
Notice how quickly children make and lose friends, right? Constantly. Why? Because children are always changing very fast and trying new ways to be, mm-hmm. right? And friends are a crucial element in that. They allow us to try out new ways of being, right? So there's constantly this change. At around 35 to 40, people's self-concept gels. Now, as I was saying before, having a new friendship, or starting a new friendship, means that you're going to be changing. And I think many people find that much more difficult.
Yeah.
And especially if you also change locale, as you did. When one of my best friends at Pittsburgh left Pittsburgh to go to Princeton, actually, and he came back for an examination or something, and we're talking, and I was asking how he was, and he said, well, you know, I've read Proust this semester. I said, how much time do you have? I said, well, you know, and he started saying how he couldn't make any new friends. And this was a very social person. I mean, we had a wonderful time together, and yet, at that point, he retreated. And I think we do, for better or worse, retreat at some point in life. And usually we say, well, then too much work, spouses, jobs, children. But that, I think, is much less important than the fear or the unwillingness to change who we are.
Well, I think that having friendships takes a huge amount of energy. I mean, this in my experience, you really have to put, you need to engage with your friends. And the older your friend, the deeper your history, maybe the less work, and the new friends, as you're saying.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of energy, and we all hope to have this energy in our work and the rest of our lives, but it's harder to develop that kind of eros with new people.
Yeah, you have more in common with, I mean, I've just in the last 3 weeks gone to a little micro reunion with four guys who went to elementary and high school.
So who was the criminal and who was the...
And now I'm here, you know, and so it's, I do feel like the friendships that are longer and in which you've done something intensive in common are two big things.
Alexander Hobbins is talking with his high school, you know, border at his high school, and for 10 years, and these guys are still all around in Athens. So he opens the book by talking about how easy it is to fall into relatively little effort, but it's hard. You haven't made many new Greek friends in Athens, right? I mean,
some, but no.
It's not,
what's,
you know,
very
it's,
easy about sometimes those relations that stop and then you recover them. I think the reason that I found it so wonderful to get in touch with my old friends who have lived their life together, literally, is that you no longer have the kind of insecurities, uncertainties, competitiveness that teenagers or even college students have toward one another. Those things really drop out as you get older, so you can actually just see the person without constantly comparing yourself to them or trying to outdo them or whatever it is. And that really, really helps, I think.
And I think you, to just paraphrase something you said, the concept of unconditional love is one you traditionally hear in a love relationship. And it basically means whatever the, I think it basically means what you just said, friendship is regardless of what happens with this person or if they do something you don't like at some level, you...
There are limits, but they're very, very
important. They're still your friend.
That's right, absolutely. You should see the things he does, you know.
Someone, Jeff, should I call people? Sorry.
I have first a comment and then a question, but I'm sitting next to my friend of 65 years out of 70 years. Few other people in my class knew my parents, she knew my grandparents, she knew what I grew up from, and I knew the same about her. That is an ineradicable basis for a friendship. Now, she or I could do something unforgivable to spoil it, I suppose,
sure.
But that connectivity makes it possible to go back to that friendship without any feeling that you're starting over, you're just picking up. And that has, in my experience, been a very valuable aspect of friendship. But my question to you, it concerns the barber.
So what?
The barber.
The barber.
You said he was, I think I'm quoting you more or less correctly, he was not that good a friend.
Yeah, he was a casual friend.
Right, yes. Is it possible at all to have that good a friend with someone for whom, who is providing you with services that you pay for? Tom changed your tire, fixes your cabinets. Neither of you, I think, would imagine any payment.
No, we bought it.
It's But how is it even conceivable to have a friendship where one person has, in effect, the power of the purse over the other?
Well, I don't think you can have, generally speaking, I don't think it's easy to have a very close friendship. But I do think that my relationship with Thomas the Barber is not one of pure instrumentality. I think we actually, I forgot to go introduce you to him yesterday. You know, I really, it's him I like. And I think that's shown by the fact that I decided not to go to a better barber, supposing that this guy was better, because I felt loyal to him. And I didn't feel loyal to him just because he provided me with a service. You see, that providing the service, the money part, doesn't create loyalty. Mm. It's whatever is left once the money part goes out, is taken out, that matters. So I think it's very difficult to have close friendships when you actually are paying people, but I don't think it's all that difficult to have a more casual friendship, and I think it's mutual, yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's an interesting question. So I've become very close friends with my cello teacher, and so he doesn't want me to pay him anymore. I find it just sort of unbearable to have him coach a group of amateurs and listen to us butchering the Schubert Quintet and not pay him, and it's his job, and so I insist on paying him. So we have a certain amount of tension about, you know, the categories.
Yeah.
That he's both a good friend.
It's very interesting.
And as a professional musician, I just couldn't bear. I couldn't bear it. So we sort of not compromise. Where I said, look, we just separate. You know, when you're coaching us, you're in your professional role, and when we bike together and hang out, you're not. So you can. I mean, I think it's possible. Don't you just split to somehow segregate parts of a friendship, a relationship like that?
No.
I suppose that's. That's possible, but I think every time you split it one way or the other, you make it more fragile.
Make it more fragile?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting. I think maybe it's different what kind of thing you do. Having someone as a music teacher is a fairly intimate relationship anyway, and so it's just different versions of intimacy. So it could, but anyway.
People do become friends with their doctors. This gentleman?
Yeah, a couple of things. This seems to go on for hours, but
4 minutes is fine before we have to get out of here.
Take an empirical point of view, Hume was very interested in this as well. And he talked about fellow feeling.
He talked about?
David Hume?
Yeah, he talked about what?
Fellow feeling.
Fellow feeling, sure.
And of course, he translated that into sympathy, but recognized, and it's been taken further with skepticism of Richard Dawkins and some others, but recognize that that's an emotional content. It's something that we have. It's not something you acquire. It's something you have. And that's something that he builds a morality on. And there's more discussions about that. And people have talked about circles of sympathy. So it starts with the self. But your family is close. Your friends are closer. But then you gradually get out into what you would call a society without sympathy, where you have to deal more in a transactional basis. And that's justice, that's ethics. And what we're really talking about is, what is it about a relationship with another non-family person that brings them into this inner circle of sympathy? It becomes an emotional connection. And exposure is one thing, and that's what we have with physician-patient relationships. It's an exposure that's more intimate than anything you could imagine in some cases. In my case, I'm an oncologist, so I've been to friends' weddings. I go to way too many funerals. But it's something that you have an emotional connection with. It doesn't happen with everybody, of course. But that can be explained more biologically than maybe you were thinking of otherwise. So the real question is,
How do you explain it biologically?
It starts with an infant. So an infant recognizes faces. Smiling releases neurons, sets thresholds, so that you feel better with a smile. If somebody smiles at you, you smile. It's a mimic reaction. So that you have an intrinsic response, but you also have a reaction when you smile. So it reinforces that feeling. Crying is the same, although...
Do you think that there's anything that we do in a conscious life that doesn't have a neurophysiological basis?
I don't.
Neither do I. But I don't think that means that friendship is just some endorphins hitting my brain.
Oh, no, it's more than that. I mean, it's what we build in ourselves. So what is something called emergent properties. And
yes.
Emergent properties of our consciousness, for instance, can't be predicted by your biologic context. And you build a self over time, and friendships build into that self, so it helps combine you. And represents a loss if you lose it. And probably the reason why we lose friendships is because they no longer have that feeling, they no longer build a self for us. So again, I'm not saying anything different than what you're saying.
I don't think, you said explained biologically, and I don't think that's quite right. It's not explained biologically, it has
he's
a biological basis.
Explained. He's saying that a neonatal infant, no language, is born with mechanisms.
Of course we are. Of course.
Of the
I mean, we don't need scientists to tell us that, so frankly.
So what I'm saying is that correlates, and then we could probably measure, in some ways, if we were sophisticated enough, what's actually happening with this friendship in terms of various biological things.
Maybe.
I know it takes a
little bit of that.
My current research is about why dogs are our best friends.
Why?
So
tell us about
we'll
it.
Have, what? No, I'm not going to tell you about it, but the interesting question is this is not cognitive, this is biological, and yet there's a huge cognitive and cultural things that go into making this intimate human-animal relationship. So, I mean, obviously it's biological. But that's not what creates this whole infrastructure, this whole mountain of relationships we have with this animal and other animals. And I think you'd say the same thing with people. I mean, obviously, there's attachment all along. We're supposed to be out of here right now.
No, one more minute.
One more minute, sorry.
Our boss is over there.
I want to ask you about relationships, friendships between couples. I was thinking about what
couples. That's a fraught
between
subject.
Couples. And I was thinking about it in the context of Wallace Stegner's incredible book about the lifelong relationships between two couples who got to know each other as academicians and writers. when they were young, and how both the relationships within the couple and between the two couples were affected by their varying careers, their varying family dynamics, the fact that they got one member of a couple would get sick and then the other was burdened with a loss. I mean, it seems to me that life is fraught with unpredictable changes in the dynamics between us because of what is thrown our way and we have very little control over, and has a great bearing on what we can turn to in ourselves and amongst our friends for solace and support. Now, in a way, Wallace Stegner was writing about a period in life when people had long-term careers, they were relatively stable, they could see one another, they had relatively stable marriages, at least in the sense of staying together. How do you think about friendship in that context, in the context of longer term intra and inter couple?
Well, I don't know very much about couples, and as a sociologist or an anthropologist would know, but what I'm trying to say about friendship starts with two individuals, but I think it can be generalized. I don't think I don't think the feelings are different. I think the behavior may be different, once again. That you do, when there are four of you and you are sort of like regular, traditional couples, male, female, or whatever, there are all kinds of things that you will do for one another that two men, or two women for that matter, would not do, right? There are other things. I can't tell you exactly what those things are. That's something for a sociologist to figure out. And the sociologists actually have tried to figure out that, they have something like 322 kinds of friendship, which shows that nobody knows. It's not as bad as it's not as bad as instincts. In the 20s, there were over 5,000 instincts that people had identified, which showed again that nobody knew what was going on. So that's the kind of thing that I'm not capable of dealing with. What I think I can deal with is the sort of very general features that distinguish, on the one hand, instrumental or impersonal relationships, and what I would call personal or friendship, friendly relationships on the other. I can't get any more specific than that, except by giving examples, as I did before with Tom, or I would do with other friends.
Okay.
So.